Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
We haven't even started deporting people back. It is going to create chaos, absolute chaos in the southern border. It is absolutely going to challenge what comes back to the United States. And I don't think there is a full plan in place, despite what Trump has said, for actually how to deal with the realities of mass movements of people. Good to see you, Jamal. Our latest episode of Trailblaze.
Good to see you. We are back after the crazy election that we had. And obviously we had last week a conversation that was not so much fun.
I think a lot of the conversations are going to be not fun, but our promise to people has always been that we'll keep it real. This is the reality we live in. And people like you and me have to navigate this reality in just a different way.
We do have to navigate it. And the truth is, you know, we talk about this as a trailblaze is about the America we're becoming, right? And so we wrestle with this question, right? Are we still becoming this America that we have been thinking about? But, you know, I mean, you're a mom. Having a kid is hard, right? Like, I haven't been through actual childbirth. But, you know, like going through this is hard. And it is not that it's going to be simple and painless and we're going to make it through to this next phase of what we're becoming because it's all going to be a glide path. It's going to be hard. And we're in the middle of the hard part.
And this is the hard part, even though the facts don't change, right? There, by 2040, we are going to be a majority minority country. We're actually probably be the first major democracy to ever have to deal with being truly multiracial. And that's part of the American experiment. And it was not necessarily what the founders intended, right? All men are created equal as long as you are white male and have property.
Right.
That's the unspoken part that's governed most of American history. And this is the America we're becoming. And we're becoming an America that is not going to be necessarily recognized on the world stage as a beacon of hope for others, or even that beacon of freedom and democracy in the way that we have wanted it to be, because Trump has delivered a clear message that he does not want to be part of a globalized economy or a global community. And project number one for that is making sure that the people that Trump and his supporters do not want in the country are going to be deported. And we have a new Homeland Security Director who is going to be, it's Kristi Noem, former governor. You may remember her as the woman who shoots dogs. When it's a quote unquote bad dog, she just shoots a dog. So she's going to be in charge. They're staffing out that Stephen Miller is going to be deputy chief of staff, right? I know many Jewish people who don't want to claim him anymore, but part of his project is also to make sure that undocumented immigrants are kicked out of the country. And people are very surprised about who is undocumented around them. There are many loyal, hardworking people who do not have their paperwork in order. And don't think that those people are going to be allowed to stay in the country just because you voted for Trump.
Yeah. Yes. Here's a place where I'm going to disagree with you is I think the America we're becoming is yet untold. Right. And so it's not as definitive to me that because Trump won and because we're going through this period where we are not going to be a beacon, that it means we are always going to be a country where we're not going to be a beacon. I think this is a country that has wrestled with really hard things over the course of its 200 and almost 50 year history. And we have come out often on the better side of those things after we've wrestled. It doesn't mean the time period in between sucked and sucked for people who were in it. I don't know if we said this the other day, but I was watching Doris Kearns Goodwin on television, and she was talking about some of the hard things. Jim Crow talking about when we went through the Great Depression. And the thing is, we came out of those things, we came out better. But when people were in the middle of them, nobody knew how we were going to come out. They just had to get up every day and push and fight and try to create the world that they wanted to create. And then the pathway began to open and the light began to shine through and knew how to guide the work to get there. So I agree with you. The interim, like what we're facing right now, is dark and it's going to be miserable and hard for a lot of people in really visceral ways. But I do not believe that that is the end of the story.
I appreciate your optimism. I think even though suffering exists in the world, so many faiths tell us that you have to get up and do what you can every single day. But this may be a period in which we do live side by side with a lot of suffering. The challenge I find is that the United States on the world stage, the brand promise of America, is going to be hard to navigate. And not, you know, 85% of Americans don't have passports. So this is a high-class problem I'm talking about right now of what it means to be America when you're traveling overseas. But our diplomats, even our military folks, and anybody who has any business people who have to deal with folks outside of this country, understand that this reality is there's an entire generation that was raised in the shadows of America's Middle East regime change wars and Afghanistan that prior to that were the coups that the United States supported in Latin America. And it's only recently that we have tried to remind folks that America, you know, while it has its own challenges, does stand up for democracy, wants to invest in free and fair elections, right? Wants to support this democratic project on the world stage. That is not Trump's answer. So since the 1980s onwards, people are already looking at America as an ally, as a partner, as a power on the world stage with really skeptical eyebrows. And right now, the skepticism isn't about, oh, will you help us in the way that we expect you to help us? But the skepticism is, we don't know what's going to happen next. Like Donald Trump hates NATO, but then he can change his mind tomorrow. So we're unreliable, right? The idea of America on the world stage and you don't know what America is going to do next, that's just a recipe for chaos. And that chaos is going to filter down to our local economies.
Yeah, you know, that's the story about America that has always been, you know, it's a complex place to live and to be a part of, because while we were doing things that we certainly weren't proud of, then we would do things that we are proud of, right? We went into Bosnia. We went into Kosovo, right? We defended Muslims in Kosovo. Like, we went into these countries and we tried
after
to...
After skipping Rwanda, right?
And made things better. We went into Somalia and it ended up going bad and we pulled out, right? But we went in, yeah. I think, for probably, like, the right reasons. And so it's a, you know, America will make you work for it. It's not going to be easy. Someone said democracy is super hard. And so we make, or as Churchill said, we after we try all the other things, we tend to get the answer right. And we are in the middle of trying a bunch of other things that are not working, probably not going to work out. You know, I think about this from having seen an era kind of at the 1990s, where soft power was the lead for Americans, right? We were the ones who were leading with, you know, the economy, with businesses. We were trying to set a moral example. We were going around the world. Our whole engagement was, a commercial strategy where America was taking companies to try to build these relationships. And then you had the Bush era came in where it was hard power, where we dropped boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we were really pushing and fighting in a hard era. And that kind of bled over into the Obama era. But Obama kind of reignited the idea that soft power might matter when it was about our morality. And he was
such a figure. Drones, so we didn't have to do boots on the ground anymore.
Yeah, but he was like a figure that people could admire. And so people said, well, if America, remember he got a Nobel Prize before he even got inaugurated, right?
Now that I think about it, it's kind of weird, to be honest. I'm like, you just got a Nobel Prize for being elected? Like, I know that's a big deal.
It was a huge deal because he actually ran against that war against Iraq, right? He ran against that. Mm-hmm. And so it was like this idea that America could be on the way back, that instead of having like an America that's marching across the world with its military, we could have an America that's more restrained and somebody who is going to be thoughtful. And I think that was a thing.
Yeah, but thoughtful now we've got this in era. Doing very targeted strikes using drones that we never talked about up until finally, late in his government. He's like, okay, we can talk about the drone strikes, because now it's kind of ridiculous. Everyone around the world knows it's happening. So we're just better off not lying to people. And I will say this, drone strikes have saved U.S. lives. They have had countless casualties overseas because of the challenge of the targeting. So it's one of those things that these tools that we use and we exercise in theory, right, to help targeting extremists have had disastrous results in local communities. So it's only ended up hurting that brand idea of America. And all of these countries that you talk about hard power, yes, they wanted us as America to help them with their hard power, right? That was fundamentally what the relationship with Saudi Arabia is about. They have oil. We can give them military power, military bases, and train up their army, right? So that's on the one side with the Gulf. We have mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia on the other side, the promise that we've made to protect the military on the other side, to protect Israel with military support, right? So that is the American footprint in the Middle East, and it's all anti-Iran. Mm-hmm. And we've paid for that. We've paid for that sincerely in many, many ways. And part of what we paid for with that alliance is that idea that America will stand up for human rights, because we don't consistently, not even remotely.
Maybe not consistently, but we stand up for human rights a lot, right? Like, I mean, it took us a long time. We got to the point where by the time we got to South Africa and you did have sanctions put in place, you did have an America that was leaning with other allies against South African government. Mandela got released, and it was in the economic interest of the white minority to do that, because America and other places made that case after pressure from internally. So again, yes, all the things, the drone strikes, which hurt people, and other things. But at the same time, we have been a constructive part. You know, we're in Ukraine right now, where we have, you know, we're funding an entire war to try to push back on Russian aggression, which mm-hmm. this administration doesn't want us to fund, because they don't mind necessarily. They just want to cut a deal with Russia and get it over with, where Russia would get whatever it wants. And then every other country would be in jeopardy. Poland, Finland, all these countries in the North Baltic. Like, it's a complicated world, as you know, because you did mm-hmm. this for a living, but it's mm-hmm. a really complicated world. The one thing I'll say is, I remember being in Vietnam, and a guy said to me, this is maybe like 10 years ago, and a guy said to me, he said, you know, the thing about America versus China is that Americans want a lot of things for themselves, right? But they're willing to cut everybody else in. The Chinese want everything mm-hmm. for themselves. Mm-hmm. Nobody else gets to participate. They just take all the benefits. So no one has any rose-colored glasses about America. But the thing about the American model is, you can get in on the deal too. We're not trying to take everything. We're actually willing to restrain ourselves in some way by being part of the UN, the World Bank, the NATO. We'll restrain ourselves in some way in order to have more people at the table and make sure we have disseminated, we distributed the benefits of our kind of hegemonic power.
Only to a point, right? Only to a point, because ultimately the United States is not a party to the Rome Statute or the International Criminal Court, because
sure.
it's not just, they're not just going to go after Israel. They would also go after many of the violations committed by the United States in Iraq and sure. Afghanistan too, right? So like there is I get that. If you have power, the number one thing you should do is protect yourself. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the conclusion though, that we've ended up with Trump. Individuals protecting themselves, not protecting everybody collectively. What that does on the world stage, it makes it very clear to other world leaders and countries that don't rely on America. Fair. Got it. You got to do what you got to do. But also start to build coalitions that don't include the United States. That's where it starts to get tricky, when we're the ones who are getting cut out of the deal because our leadership is inconsistent and you don't know what we're going to do next. And you already see this with Russia, South Africa, India, China.
The BRICS countries, right?
Like, they're right.
Brazil.
Thank you. Where they're literally like, we're going to create our own little group here that's all about protecting our peace separate from America. And this is the direct consequence of how American elections impact America's power on the world stage. It is based on what Trump has told the American public. It is what the American public, by 5 million voters, has said that they wanted. But there are short-term impacts, and the longer-term consequences are going to be severe. And we haven't even started deporting people back, right? It's something that other countries had thought about doing with Syrian refugees. It is going to create chaos, absolute chaos, in the southern border. It is absolutely going to challenge what comes back to the United States. And I don't think there is a full plan in place, despite what Trump has said, for actually how to deal with the realities of mass movements of people. Because currently the answer is people are moving for a variety of reasons, climate change, conflict, all of this, everywhere in the world. This is the number one crisis of the mass movement of people. And Trump's answer is anywhere else but here, to pretend like we are not in the same boat as everybody else. Again,
but
this
he's
is a long-term
alone.
View.
But he's not alone, right? Because that's the same conversation happening in France. It's the same conversation happening in Italy. It's the same conversation happening across Europe. And so the Northern Hemisphere countries that are all wealthier, right, are all in this place where lower birth rates, you know, high incomes, and you've got youth bulges in the South, and you've got climate change in the South pushing people out for climate reasons, and you've got the attraction of coming north to make some of the money that, you know, people want to get. So the cultural problem of that is something that everybody is trying to manage. And we are about to go through, I think, a very dark period of how we manage it, because we're going to really try to just clamp down on it. And it's going to...
And here's the irony, right? You talk to, for example, in Ohio, those towns that have Haitian migrants in them, it actually helped their local economy. The mayor will tell you, this has been economically good for us. It's made housing more affordable. We have the workers we need. Like, stuff is happening in our town that wasn't happening before. The problem comes in when people feel like good things should not be coming from cultural change. And we've seen that happen. Like, no, cultural change is bad, fundamentally bad. I don't care if it's helping the economy. I don't want it. And that's like, there is, I don't think any economist has argued that the mass deportation of undocumented people is going to help America's economy. Because frankly, our chicken farms in the United States and chicken processing plants run on undocumented cheap labor. That's how they make things work right now, right? So that whole idea of inflation, it's going to happen when you start to lose cheap, undocumented labor. Germany wanted Syrian refugees because many of them were engineers. They had a labor shortage. Russia, do you know where they get their labor from? They get it from the stands, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan. Like, every country, by and large, that is expanding and growing its economy needs cheap labor from somewhere. So there's an argument that can be made of how to do this the right way, right? To make it acceptable and dealable. But that is the cultural changes that come that people can't handle.
And this gets to one of the core concepts of why we're even talking to each other, you know, in this podcast right now, and people hopefully are listening to this, is because how we manage that cultural change matters. And I think one thing that none of us have done a good job at on the left, or the people who are interested in trying to knit the country together, is how we talk to white working class people about what their role is going to be in an America where these cultural changes have occurred. Trump is talking to those people, right? Trump has said,
do we know?
Says,
like, here's the thing. I don't think we know what the role is going to be, right?
But this is the problem, though. Here's the thing. We're not actually even addressing the angst and the anxiety that they have. Trump goes in, he names the anxiety, he talks about it, and then he blames brown people for it. Right. He says the problem is the liberal elites and the brown people are making your life miserable. And so people say, wow, nobody else is even talking to me about this. So if Trump has an idea, maybe I'll follow that guy, because at least he understands this problem exists. We try to tell people they shouldn't feel badly. You know, the world is changing. It'll all be okay. It'll all work out.
Or I think actually what's worse, you know what I think is actually worse than that?
And people are like, y'all don't know what you're talking about. This sucks.
You know what else I think is worse is when we tell people we're going to bring back the economies that are gone. Right. The idea we'll bring back manufacturing. We're going to bring back the coal jobs. And it's like, that doesn't happen. Right. That doesn't happen. And so how do you do a better job?
But in lieu of nothing, they'll grab on something, because at least somebody's making them a promise to try to change something.
The answer then is what? Democrats should get better at lying to people?
No, but Democrats should come up with a theory of the case, right? We should think about, because look, here's one of the problems. Trump right now is talking about tariffs, because he's making the argument that if he increases tariffs, if he increases tariffs on other countries, then that will enable American manufacturing. But it's a dodge. You know why? Because the whole trade dislocation is 90% done. We've had all of that stuff.
It ain't
horrible.
Coming back.
It's already happened.
It ain't coming back.
You know what's really going to happen? What's really going to happen is AI. AI is going to displace far more American workers than trade is going to displace. But Trump's in bed with all the AI people. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't want you focused on AI. He wants you thinking about a problem that's actually already occurred instead of the problem that's coming, that he's in bed with the people who are going to benefit for this when this AI onslaught sort of hits the American shore.
Yeah, he's essentially recycled all of the narratives from the 1980s, right? The Reagan narratives that were underlying everything, that here's who you can blame. There's good immigrants and there's bad immigrants. And there's, you know, there's a good way to do jobs overseas and then a bad way to do that. And like you said, 90% of the manufacturing is gone. What's going to end up happening is a company like Apple is going to look around and say, you know, we're just not going to invest in the American market in the same way, because your tariffs are now going to make iPhones like almost double the price for consumers. Americans are not going to buy an Apple iPhone that is double the price. Like, they're like, that's just not going to happen. So when you're putting a tariff on even these allies that we have for their products, the American consumer is the one who pays the price. The company ain't going to take the hit on their supply chain. They're not going to do that. And so you actually will have fewer options of things and items that you want here in the United States rather than more. So it's the promise of tariffs is another, it's a sledgehammer response, right?
No,
like, I'm going to take a sledgehammer to this problem, and you're going to feel good that you saw me coming out swinging and taking a sledgehammer to it. And I wish it was that easy. That's what I've learned from my time in policy and government and all this stuff, is that it's not, there are ripple effects. And if you don't think about those ripple effects, you end up doing more damage with the sledgehammer than you do actually building new things.
Yeah, but not addressing the problem is not working, right? Like,
no,
not naming
true.
It for people, mm-hmm. and not saying, like, we understand that you feel some discomfort about this, and we're going to help you try to navigate this. And here's some, you know, I mean, you know, person who tries to do it is like Bernie Sanders. The problem is he doesn't really have like an ethnic lens. He doesn't really have a lens that talks about people of color mm-hmm. in his analysis. It's rooted in like a 1930s, you know, kind of union socialist movement that doesn't really apply to.
Well, I will say unions are booming with young people right now.
They are booming. But this is a modern union thing, right? And a lot of those are SEIU. They're service workers. They're not mm-hmm. necessarily people who are in big factories. And so, and although some of them are, right, laborers are starting to do a really interesting thing to get people trained. But we got to come up with an analysis that's modern, that includes the cultural dynamic and not just the economic dynamics, where I think Bernie's analysis falls short. He doesn't quite capture the cultural changes that are happening alongside the economic problems people are facing. But we have an administration that isn't necessarily just doing hard power. It isn't just doing soft power. I call it puzzle power, right? Because nobody understands it. Right? It's a puzzle that people can't really... People can't really decipher it. And so what happens when you have a foreign policy or economic policy that people don't understand is mistakes happen. And when mistakes mm-hmm. happen on the global stage, people die. And I think they are not taking into effect that this idea that he's going to be ambiguous and nobody will know what it is, and he's going to just cut deals with people, you know, for money, basically for himself and maybe for the country, but maybe for other people. But certainly the Trump family will get cut in. If he just cuts deals with people, he can manage the world that way, like a businessman who's just trying to build a new hotel.
Oh, well, that was under the Abraham Accords. That was Jared Kushner's entire presentation when he brought all these economic bigwigs and business people to the West Bank, was to build high rises in the West Bank. He certainly doesn't want to be building high rises under Palestinian Authority control, right? He wants to turn it into a tourist development center under Israeli control. That's the promise that's been made, and fully expect that is part of the plan, given everything we've heard coming out of Netanyahu's policies the last week, right? They don't want people going back into Gaza. In the northern Gaza.
We got a minister right now who's saying, one of the economic ministers who's saying, maybe the finance minister, who's saying that, you know, that we should just annex part of Gaza and develop it for Israel.
Oh, well, right? the settler, right, the person who's going to be, the person who's going to be the new Israeli ambassador to the United States is himself a settler activist. Like, his whole reason for moving to Israel was to expand the boundaries of Israel into the West Bank. That's going to be the guy working with the Trump administration. So that's a given of what's going to happen there. When the U.S. makes mistakes, people die, I'm not convinced that necessarily matters when it comes to voting, other people dying.
Well, which Americans might die
too. A really dark way.
Because what we've learned is that people aren't going to just sit by and die by themselves, right? Like they are willing to bring the problem to our shore.
People will care when voters will care when Americans start dying, right? And we don't have a draft now like we did back in the day. We have an all-volunteer military that is 40% people of color that gets promised all sorts of things they could never get in their day-to-day life, like, you know, an education and job stability and retirement. They're the ones who go do the work. So it only impacts a certain segment of American society. This is, we're not going to have a Vietnam War protest movement.
1% of the American society serves in the military.
Yeah, it's not. It is very, and the decisions are made by people whose children are not and will not have to serve. So that's part of the.
And many of them are white. And I think, you know, I guess I go back to this point. What Trump is selling is a short-term bomb. There will be a point where it becomes obvious that it's not working.
Short-term, right? B-A-L-M, right? Not B-O-M-B.
B-A-L-M.
Because I could also see it.
Exactly.
Exactly. The other one.
Thank you for helping me in our podcast. B-A-L-M, bomb. If we on the left don't figure out how to build a relationship and community with people who are feeling left out and feeling like nobody's advocating for them, when Trump fails, they're not going to see us as credible actors to help them. And that is the thing that I think we have. That is the project that I think that we have to be on. And that project isn't just about white people. It's also about people of color. It's also about Latinos and African-American men and Asian-Americans who are from communities that we don't think about very much. Like, we've got to figure out how it is that we on the left have an argument with them about how we can help make their lives better and policies that are going to actually be implemented to do it or else, and relationships, like just genuine relationship and conversation. Because if not, when Trump fails, they're just going to check out. They're not going to come and follow us. They're just going to check out and we'll still be in the place where we are.
Well, I think this is the problem that we saw, is that this idea of multiracial democracy in coalition, this rainbow coalition, doesn't exist in the same way. Now, granted, by and large, the people that you mentioned and those different communities did vote for Harris, but enough margins have been swinging and enough people stayed home where it doesn't, people are looking at each other like, you don't support me when I need help. We're like, that's already happening. And that idea is falling apart. I think it works on an interpersonal level, like one-on-one conversations and friendships and relationships. But I think as a mass systemic project, the Democratic Party certainly is not capable of making that happen as the party is right now. So something's really going to have to change.
Well, we're going to have to figure out how to shake it up. And people have to recognize that the politics have changed. People don't care about the rules. People don't care about how things have been done in the past. People want politics that are going to affect them. And if you got to break some eggs along the way, that's fine. And if you bring us a candidate that's got some skeletons, that's fine, as long as they're doing something. And so we got to, I think, more people who are, you know, more principals of schools, more shop stewards, more people who have, you know, leading parent associations. We've got to start running candidates that come from communities and putting them at every level of the government. So, because the Republicans have been running a project that doesn't, it's not just the presidency. They are up and down the line infiltrating all of the ways that we make decisions in our communities, and we're suffering for it.